Danish present Doctor Who Short Trips. A Small Semblance of Home by Paul Phipps. Read by Carol Ann Ford. It's Sunday. She's certain this time. The day of rest. The day to spend with friends and family. Definitely. Without a shadow of a doubt. Sunday. Barbara Wright brushes the sleep from her eyes and looks at her tiny notebook once again. It was an old thing, bought when she'd been appointed to Coal Hill School. 2 inches high and half as wide, she'd first used it to learn the names of her students, jotting down scraps of information so she'd recall them the following day. It had been this notebook within which she'd first scribbled down the name Susan Foreman. It had been this notebook which she'd shown to Ian. In some ways, it was this little notebook she blamed for her feeling so, so tired. Barbara takes out the stubby pencil from its holder one more time. She glances at her watch and makes another tiny little mark next to the 40 or 50 similar ones which dot the page in regular, smart lines. 7 hours asleep in the ship. 4 hours beforehand on the planet they'd just left. So it was now Sunday. Or had it been longer? Definitely seemed like longer. She wanders over to the food machine, deep in thought, and turns the dial to black coffee. After 3 seconds of the most random beeps and whistles yet, the drawer at the bottom dispenses a thick black soup, which smells like burnt aniseed. Barbara sighs, turns her back on the contraption, and walks away. She finds Ian at the door to the console room, watching the doctor carefully studying the position of each lever on the console. She flicks over a couple of pages in the notebook. Ian, how long were we on... He waves his hand and she stops. Shh, he says in a conspiratorial whisper. Look at him. He'll stand there, just staring at the switches. He'll pause, move one an inch and then... Look there. He's doing it now. And then he'll move it right back, as if he's made a terrible mistake. Look, there, see? He swears he knows what he's doing, but I don't think he's got a clue. That's as reassuring as ever, whispers Barbara. Listen, how long were we on that last planet? 4 hours? Ian shakes his head and smiles. It was more like 14. You were so tired. You slept on the caravan to the chief botanist's palace. I didn't want to wake you, and you looked so peaceful. Oh, Ian, she says, slumping into a chair. I've lost count. I don't know what day it is anymore. I've been trying to keep track, but there's nothing here that helps. We land, and in my head, it's the middle of the day. But we walk outside, and it's night. The ship has no sunsets, no sunrise, and every single clock is set to a different period of time. I wish... Ian bends down and cups her hands in his own. That you could just turn on the radio and hear good old Big Ben on the home service. She nods. Something to remind me of home, I suppose. We came here with just the clothes we were wearing, and even they're worn out. I just need something. Anything. I know, Barbara, I know. Ian looks back towards the console room. I think it would do you good to slow down. Do us both a world of good. The doctor's been at this quest of his for days now, and he expects you to keep the same pace he does. Besides, he's becoming a little obsessed with this experiment of his. Everywhere we stop, he demands we leave in search of his precious plant. Let me go and talk to him. Barbara squeezes his hand and watches him walk over to the doctor. That one. No, 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 no. That's not right. Mm-hmm. Perhaps a... Yes, that's which. Ah, good morning, Chesterton. I trust you slept well. I see you found the new cardigan I left for you. Very fetching. Very fetching indeed. Ian adjusts his tie without thinking. Yes, thank you, Doctor, he says. The last one did get a bit frayed after that business with the fire ants. The doctor dismisses the memory with a sharp wave. Yes, unfortunate business. You almost had one less hand to point at me with. Ian starts to reply, but the grinding engines of the TARDIS begin to increase in volume. Several lights on the console blink in unison, and Ian feels the familiar lurch in his stomach as the ship begins to land. As the central column finally falls to rest, Ian's reminded of the sound and burning smell of a car running dangerously low on oil. Now, says the doctor, pulling every lever into a resting position, kindly tell Susan and Barbara we've landed. We mustn't waste a moment if we're to collect the plant I need for my experiments. I've got good feelings about this. Look at the readings, hmm? Look at them. 72.5 degrees Fahrenheit. I must check the soil outside at once. I need my instruments. Where are my instruments? Ian raises his hand. Doctor, wait, he says. You've got to stop this. Barbara's exhausted, and so am I. Everywhere we land, no matter how cold or how wet, you get us looking for this blasted plant. We walked for 7 miles across marshland last week, hunted by swamp creatures. And for what? A twig you burnt in 5 seconds. You're obsessed. It's like Scarrow all over again. The doctor turns on his heels so Ian doesn't see the anger in his face. I've apologised for that. You have no idea the reasons behind my work. How dare you? You're a scientist, Chesterton. I expect you to understand, and if you don't, then you're under no obligation to stay. Ian's shoulders slump and he crosses his arms. This was a losing battle. It always was when the doctor employed his my ship, my rules argument. He looks back towards Barbara, who shakes her head. Leave it, she mouths. I'll talk to Susan. The doctor adjusts the brim of his Panama hat to shield his eyes from the glare of the single yellow sun and strides confidently off into the distance. Susan closes the door to the TARDIS. I'm sure he doesn't mean it, she says, with a weak smile. But once Grandfather has his mind on something... You don't say, sighs Ian. And he didn't tell you what his experiments are or why this planet is so important to him? No, she says, because if he had, I'd tell you. Honest, I would. But there's a good reason, I know there is. Give him a chance, please. Ian looks to Barbara. All right, Susan, she sighs. For now. She looks around before closing her eyes in the warmth of the sun. Standing there, she can almost believe it's Shoreditch Park in summer, and she's waiting for her friends to arrive with their picnic. I wonder where they all are now, she thinks, and I wonder what they would say if they could see me here. She opens her eyes on this rocky cliff face without a speck of life to its name. She looks to see Susan running off towards her grandfather and Ian by her side, offering her his arm. Come on, he says, with an optimistic smile. Another new sky, another new day in time and space. They catch up with the doctor and Susan at the edge of a rocky path overlooking a valley of barren grey mountains. As they approach, Susan runs back towards them, a childlike glee beaming across her face. Oh, Ian! Barbara, come and see! Isn't it wonderful? Barbara takes her hand, Susan's excitement almost infectious. What is it, Susan? She smiles. Despite her fatigue and despite her better judgment, she can feel the giddy sense of wonder slowly beginning to return. There were days when she would teach Susan about the places they'd visit and see the understanding dawn in her eyes. there were others, like today, when the girl would just take her by the hand and show her what the universe had to offer. "Down there," points Susan. "Can you see? Grandfather, give her your glasses." The doctor turns to them, almost startled to see them approach. "It's extraordinary, most extraordinary. I must get a better look. And there you are, my dear." He passes a small set of brass opera glasses to Susan, who gives them straight to Barbara with a smile. "What is it, doctor?" asks Ian, catching up. The old man's eyes are gleaming. "Life, my boy. Life, where it's not expected. I told you this would be the place, didn't I? At first glance, you look around and all you see is rock and stone. But you turn a corner, you open your eyes and you find life. Always life. Remarkable. Most remarkable. Now come with me. I'll need your help." He presses a small plastic specimen box into Ian's hands and starts to descend the mountainside without further discussion. Ian shakes his head and goes after him. "Why, that's astonishing," says Barbara, as she presses the opera glasses to her eyes for a second time. "A perfect circle of grass, nestled in the mountainside with a single small tree in its centre." "It's magnificent," says Susan. "It's what Grandfather was hoping for. I haven't seen him so happy in a long while. It's like nature decided to paint in pure green. The grass looks so inviting. I can't wait to take off my shoes and lie back in the shade." She turns back to Barbara. "Perhaps we can go back to the ship. I know the codes to produce the most wonderful picnic." "Hold on a moment, Susan," says Barbara, looking once more towards the circle of grass. "I'm not sure about this. Doesn't it seem, well, a little out of place? How did it get there? Who cuts the grass? It's almost like a mirage. In all of this grey rock and dust, wouldn't you want to see the most beautiful thing you could think of?" She pockets the opera glasses and starts off in the men's footsteps. "Come on, Susan, we need to catch up with the doctor." Ian barely has time to catch his breath before the doctor's clicking his fingers in impatience. For once, the old man seems as fresh as the moment he woke this morning. Ian shakes his head in amazement. He'd lost count of the number of times the doctor's age had impaired him in some way, delayed their journey while he rested, or forced them into some dangerous inn to stay the night. But today, as whenever there's a new discovery to be made, his energy is almost limitless. Ian passes the doctor his box of instruments with a smile. "Is this what we've been looking for all this time, doctor?" The old man claps his hands in delight. "I'm not sure. I must check. Oh, my boy, if it is, I can't wait to tell you what this means." He bends down at the edge of the grass circle and opens the box. He takes out a strip of pink paper and dips it into the soil. "Moderately acidic," he exclaims. "Look, Chesterton, the soil. It's perfect." "So I see," says Ian, beginning to think the doctor might actually be onto something this time. "The other planets we visited were far too alkaline." He takes the strip of paper, which had turned a dirty golden yellow. "So, what do you think this is, doctor? 5.5? 5.6? Pretty much Earth-like. This isn't Earth, is it?" He looks up at the sky out of habit. But there, in the deep blue of the morning sky, there was not an alien star to be seen. You could almost believe... The doctor taps his walking stick against the rock three times. "No, my boy, this isn't your world. And from my calculations, we're a good couple of thousand years into your future. But if I were to guess, I'd say the soil originated on Earth. Yes, most probable." He points the stick at the top of the tree. "Now, I'm rather tired after all this excitement. Be a good fellow and fetch me a branch from the very top, would you?" Ian sighs. "Goodbye, boundless energy," he thinks. "Although it'd be amusing to watch the doctor climb the tree. It's probably for the best if I crack on and do it myself, while he regains his strength. He steps onto the grass, which squelches underfoot. The mountainside and everything else in sight seems dry and lifeless. But here, it's as if the entire planet's natural resources have been drained to nurture this small circle of land. Each footstep leaves an imprint in its soggy path, and as he takes each cautious step forward, Ian begins to feel as if he's encroaching on something precious. "Are you sure about this, Doctor?" he calls as he reaches the base of the tree. "Quite sure, my boy, quite sure," the doctor replies, mopping his brow with a handkerchief. "This is the one. It'll be worth it, just you see. And after this, we can all relax for a while, I promise you." "I'll hold you to that," he mutters as he jumps for the first branch about an inch from the top of his head. He pulls himself up, testing to see if it will hold his weight. Satisfied, he reaches the next one, then the next. "Do you know what?" he shouts with a smile. "I'm enjoying this. It reminds me of the tree in my grandparents' back garden. I used to climb it every Sunday when I was a boy. Never once fell off. Had a couple of minor scares, but..." He strains as he reaches for the uppermost branch. There! Just the thing he was looking for. A small branch right at the top, with a couple of young leaves just bursting into life. He reaches forward, but his foot slips, almost sending him crashing to the grass below. "Ah," he cries, "almost. See, still got the old tree climbing magic." He grasps for the small branch and snaps it off at its base. "Got you. I'm on my way back down." He takes his time coming back, the journey not as easy as he remembered. He jumps the last couple of feet to the grass, but as he turns, with a smile on his face, it falls as he sees Susan running down the mountainside. "Grandfather! Ian! Look out! Behind you!" He spins to see 20, 30, 40 men emerge from hiding places along the rock face. Wearing only the barest of cloth, their bodies and shaved heads are caked in chalk and clay. A perfect camouflage against the bleak canvas of the mountain. Ian runs back to the doctor, throwing the small branch into the specimen box, which he clips to his belt. He scoops up a larger branch as the tribe surrounds the two of them, waving it in front of him. "Keep back!" he shouts. "Keep back! I'm warning you! Barbara, Susan, run!" He glances back towards the two women as Susan screams, her cry becoming muffled as a rough hand covers her mouth. "Let them go!" he shouts as they're carried away. He starts to run towards them, swinging his branch at the nearest tribesman, but the man's too fast. With one swift movement, it's knocked from his hand. A sweep of a spear to the back of his knees knocks Ian to the ground as Barbara and Susan disappear into the darkness of a nearby cave. He scrambles to his feet, but the pressure of the doctor's walking stick on his shoulder keeps him in his place. "Enough, Chesterton. We'll need words, not violence. There are too many of them for you to handle all by yourself." Ian glares up at the doctor. "But Barbara, Susan, we'll be quite all right." The doctor turns to the tallest tribesman. Whereas the others were caked in just grey mud and chalk, this man had additional streaks of terracotta running across his scalp. "Won't they, sir? Now tell me, what is the meaning of this? I demand you release my companions at once. Who are you, and what do you want?" The man tilts his head, taking his time to observe every last detail about the two travellers. He walks around them, the doctor turning on his heels to maintain eye contact at all times. The tribe surrounds them in a circle, keeping their distance. "The man's inspecting us," thinks Ian. "If we pass his inspection, we live. If we fail, they'll kill us in seconds." Eventually, the man speaks. "Who are you?" he scowls. "We are travellers," says the doctor, bringing himself up to his full height and grasping his lapel as if it gave him extra authority. "Men of science, admiring this fine botanical specimen you have here. And I believe I asked you the question first." The man suppresses a snarl.
"I am Nailok, leader of the Sinensis," he says. "And you have desecrated our sacred ground."
Ian glances at the doctor as his stance softens and his hands return to the top of his walking stick. "Ah, I see. I apologise. I must make it up to you. The Sinensis, eh? Very interesting. Originally from Earth, I take it. But from the looks of your clothing and decoration, you must have left a very long time ago. You should be exploring the stars in the spacecraft of your peers, but you choose to huddle amongst the rocks, emulating the tribes of your ancestors. Why is that? What have you lost?" Nailok peers into the doctor's eyes, exploring the unknown depth he finds within them.
"I know nothing of our ancestors and their ways. We protect the leaves because we have always protected the leaves. It is our way. The leaves are sacred, yet your soldier brandishes them as a weapon. The path before us is clear. You must all die."
The doctor stumbles back as the circle of men constrict around them, each one gripping a pointed wooden spear.
"Wait,"
he calls, helping Ian back to his feet, his eyes darting from man to man. "You protect the tree, yet you do not know why?"
"Its secrets are long lost,"
shouts Nailok as the tribe advances. Ian darts to the left as a tribesman lunges at him with his spear. He grabs the stick before it reaches the doctor, wresting it from the man's clutches and sending him crashing to the ground. The tribe continues to advance, and even as Ian grips the spear with two hands, he knows it's no match for the 20 that face him.
"But what if I could teach you the ways of that plant, eh?"
the doctor shouts back, one hand returning to his lapel.
"What if I could tell you the stories of the things it could do? You told us it was sacred, and it is. You believe it is precious, and it is. My dear Nailok, what you possess is a specimen like no other. Kill me, kill my friends, and each and every one of you will never understand the joy it can bring."
Nailok's frown deepens in rage, but he holds up his hand. The tribesmen stop their advance.
"You threaten me, old man, only with the promise of lives wasted in ignorance.
I've seen many tribes like yours, my dear Nailok, but all of them have a purpose. All of them know what they fight for and what they protect."
He takes a step forward, placing his hand on Ian's shoulder as the teacher lowers his stolen spear. He steps up to Nailok and lowers his voice.
"Wouldn't you like to know as well? I will tell you a story, sir. I am a scientist, a man of the universe, a man of the stars. But in all my travels, I've never seen a plant more precious than the one you protect. It's evolved, of course, in the thousands of years since I saw it last. More of a hybrid now, part bush, part tree, stoic through the ages. But it's a plant of great power. In certain circumstances, Its leaves can transport a person back in time. In others, it can make moments seem like hours. In times of great darkness, it can make a person more steadfast for the future. I've seen revolutions begin over its treatment. I've seen wars end when it is shared. Free my companions, and its secrets will be yours for the rest of time. Nylock stares, feeling the eyes of his tribe on his back. The wind whistles through the leaves behind him, and the familiar scent of his youth is carried on its breeze. Power, he thinks. The power to slow time? The power to strengthen and embolden the tribe? He will learn how to harness this power and then kill the trespassers before him. Go on, he says, the thinnest of smiles forming on his lips. Teach me your secrets. Susan's voice echoes through the cave. Grandfather! She bangs on the walls, but that too seems swallowed by the darkness. Grandfather! Anyone? Barbara slumps against the wall and sinks to the floor. It's no use, Susan. They can't hear us. But they might if we keep shouting. They may be looking for us right now. Or there may be another tribe, a friendly tribe. Perhaps we can get their attention and they'll help free us. And we can find my grandfather and leave this awful place. She bangs the walls once again. Barbara runs her hands through her hair. Enough, Susan. It won't do any good. Susan opens her mouth to shout once more, but thinks better of it as she sees the look in her friend's face. She crashes down next to her and places her head in Barbara's lap. I should have talked to him, the girl says, choking back tears. I should have asked him to take off straight away, like you asked. It's all my fault. I'm sorry. I just wish he wasn't so selfish, Barbara says with a sigh, stroking the back of Susan's hair. He said he'd never repeat what happened on Skaro, but here we are, locked up again, because he wanted to collect something for his precious experiments. Do you know what day it is, Susan? Susan shakes her head and wipes another tear from her eye. Is it important? She says. Time is relative. The day is wherever we land. And if we're on board the TARDIS, well, there are no days. There can't be. We're not revolving around a star. We're on no planet completing its cycle. I don't know the rotational pattern nor the size of this planet. And I don't know what calendar they use, so I don't know what day it is. She looks up at Barbara. Sorry. Barbara smiles. Of course you don't, she thinks. It's your answers to questions like that which made me follow you to that junkyard in the first place. I think it's a Sunday, she says. It certainly feels like a Sunday. Do you know what I'd be doing if I were in London right now? Seeing my mother for Sunday lunch. I don't know how she does it, but the minute I walk through the door, the kettle starts whistling on the stove, right on cue. Every single time, as if by magic. She'd warm the pot, and 5 minutes later, she'd be in her armchair, asking me to tell her all about my week. I remember the last time I saw her, I told her all about you and how crazy you were. How crazy you were making me. But it's funny, isn't it? Susan sits up. What's funny? It's the little things you miss the most. The smell of my mother's house. And the Sunday roast in the oven. The sound of that kettle whistling on the stove. Susan squeezes Barbara's arm. It'll get better one day, I promise.
She scrambles to her feet at the sound of tribesmen marching through the cave.
Grandfather! Ian! Perhaps they're here to rescue us, she hopes. Perhaps they're here to free us and take us back to the ship.
But as the first tribesmen emerge from the darkness, it's clear there's no kindness to be found in their eyes. And as the men advance towards them with their hands outstretched, Susan closes her eyes and screams.
Give me the canister!
Nylock shouts at the doctor, reaching out for the object in the old man's hand.
Not until I see my granddaughter and Miss Wright safe and unharmed, with Chesterton by my side.
Nylock nods at the two tribesmen holding Ian, with his hands behind his back. They release him, and the teacher walks over, rubbing his wrists. He looks at the canister in the doctor's hands and raises an eyebrow. He'd expected the doctor to return from the TARDIS with some futuristic apparatus, a gadget with wires and dials galore. Not something so mundane or so ordinary. I had one of those in my car every morning, Ian says under his breath. I take it your experiment worked.
It did, my boy. I'll tell you all about it when we're safely back on board the ship.
He turns back towards the tribe.
Now, where are the others? Ah!
The doctor smiles as Susan sprints down the mountain, almost knocking the air from him as she rushes to embrace him.
Hello, my dear. If you could just give me a moment, hmm? Are you unharmed, Barbara?
Very good, very good. He walks up to Nylock and throws the canister into his arms before turning on his heels and walking away.
Open it quickly, sir. Treasure it, savour it, protect it, and keep your history alive. I've left you instructions on how to replicate what's inside. Good day!
He hurries away as fast as he can, Ian, Barbara and Susan straight behind as the tribe gather around their leader. The man sinks to his knees, in awe of the strange object in his hands. It seemed to be made of silver metal, about 12 inches long and half as thick. One end is made of a dark, shiny material. Truly a rarity amongst the rocks. It's got a deep lid of some kind, which comes off in his hands to reveal a small metal cap. He holds the canister to his ear, feeling the weight change as the content shifts inside. With shaking hands, he begins to unscrew it. This is the moment he's dreamt of, he thinks, seeing the adulation in the eyes of the rest of his tribe.
Power. All the power he'll ever need.
The travellers have the TARDIS in sight as they hear Nylock's cry of rage echo across the mountains.
Run! Shouts the doctor, glancing behind them to see the tribe gather pace and begin to catch up. What did you give him? Shouts Barbara, gasping for breath. I couldn't see!
Ian stumbles but keeps running.
Not what they were expecting, I bet. But I have a very good idea.
The doctor catches his eye and grins as he fumbles for his keys, panting for breath. The first spear bounces off the TARDIS as he opens the door, and the last thing he hears before they close behind him is the sound of Nylock's defiant roar and a promise to make them pay for their deceit. The central column rises and falls once again as Barbara shakes the dust from her skirt. She takes out her notebook and makes another small mark on the page. A couple of hours at the most. Sunday afternoon. Ian is leaning against the door to the doctor's laboratory with an amused look on his face.
What are you looking so happy about? She asks.
He leans in and gives her a hug.
You'll see. Come on.
He leads her over to the food machine as the laboratory door opens and the doctor emerges.
Ah, there you are. Pull up a chair, Chesterford. You too, Barbara, my dear. Susan, fetch a tray, will you?
What's going on, Doctor? Barbara asks, a tinge of annoyance in her voice. I do hope it was worth all the trouble you put us through.
The doctor chuckles, the light sparkling in his eyes. Do you want to explain, my boy? I have one final process to complete.
Ian relaxes back in his chair.
He didn't lie to them in a way, he says. Nylock just interpreted it differently, that's all.
He looks over to the doctor as the old man takes two leaves and places them in the food machine. He turns the dial and it beeps into life.
The tribe was called the Sinensis. They'd been protecting this plant for hundreds of years, doing whatever they could to protect it. I almost realised at the time, the Sinensis as in...
Barbara's eyes widen.
You don't mean... Ian beams. I do, as in Camellia Sinensis, the Latin name for... tea!
The doctor proudly places a tray on the table containing four delicate china cups, a small jug of milk, and a grand china teapot decorated with ornately painted purple flowers.
A drink that can transport a person back through time, through their fondest memories, he says with a gleeful smile. A drink that can make moments feel like hours. And a drink, he says, pouring a cup for Barbara, that can shine light on even the darkest of days. Somehow, millennia ago, their ancestors crashed on that planet and planted a tea bush. They've been protecting it ever since, and over the centuries, they forgot why.
Ian takes a sip.
And Nylock didn't take kindly to the thermos flask of tea you gave him. No magic potion, no ultimate power.
Some people have no taste, the doctor says. No taste at all.
I know things haven't been easy, my dear, and that's why I've been looking for this plant, these tea leaves, because I knew it was the one thing I could do to make this silly old ship a little more comforting for you. A small semblance of home is all that's needed sometimes to get you through each day.
Believe me, he says, looking at his granddaughter. I know.
Barbara takes the delicate cup in both hands, holds it under her nose and closes her eyes.
I can see it, she thinks, the kettle whistling on the stove. I can smell it, the scent of the tea brewing by the open window whilst the lamb roasts in the oven. She takes the smallest of sips and sees her mother smiling in her armchair, the teacup by her side. One day, I'll tell you all about my travels, all my adventures through time and space. One day, I'll make you tea and share all of the stories your daughter can tell. I may be far away, but know that I'm with friends. And I'm happy.
For the first time she can remember, Barbara Wright relaxes with a cup of tea in her hands and a smile as the TARDIS spins off into Sunday afternoon, closer than ever to home.